on Broadway Videos. This week on Broadway, we talk with Jesse Mueller. Peter reviews The Heidi Chronicles and Hunchback of Notre Dame at Paper Mill Playhouse. Michael reviews Manon at the Met and Standard Time with Michael Feinstein. We also talk about the Stanley Drama Awards at Wagner College. The Fantastics is closing, and Jason Alexander replaces Larry David in Fish in the Dark coming up in June. Toys R Us is also leaving us in Times Square. How will that affect the Broadway community? That plus some more. Please stay tuned. This week on Broadway for Sunday, March 29th, 2015. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His new one is The Great Parade, to be released on April 7th, just a mere 9 days from now or so. And it'll be available everywhere, like your Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com, other places. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talk and Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com, as well as many of the places on the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
With us this morning, we have a very special guest. Back for her second time on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway is Jesse Mueller. Jesse, thank you so much for getting up on a Sunday morning and talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I was about to say, should I say morning? When are you playing this? Do we need?
Well, it plays all over the world over the next week, so people can listen to it at many different times during the day. So we never really know. So we try to be time neutral and things like that.
Time neutral. Good morning. Good afternoon. And good evening.
Exactly. Exactly.
Just covered it all.
So I was very concerned, and we really wanted to get you back on because last time that you were on was February 24th, 2013, and you were doing the Carousel Concert for the Philharmonic.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's February 24th, so just a little bit more than 2 years ago, and
yeah,
and nothing has really happened in your world, and I really want to make sure that you get some work because you're
Thank
such
you
a
guys.
Huge...
I hear, you know, that FaceTime ear time is important in
yeah.
that business, so I appreciate it.
You're a huge talent, and I don't know why nobody's casting you in anything.
Well, that's the biz.
That's the show biz. That's right.
That's the show biz.
So, oh my goodness gracious, you went from zero to 100 million in just a matter of weeks right after we talked to you, and Beautiful became this huge breakout hit, and you won some awards or something that I heard. Mm-hmm.
Shiny things.
Where do you keep your shiny things? We always ask people, where's your shiny things kept?
You know what? I was just sort of moving them the other day because I was trying to be good and I was trying to clean. So the Tony is in my bedroom right now, which is a little weird. I put it on my dresser because we have an office and I'm trying to actually get it to a place where it's functional. So I moved a lot of the things out. I haven't seen the Grammy yet. I just signed some paperwork that said, you know, please send it to some address and it'll pick it up
your
somewhere.
Your doorman will get it.
Yeah. If I had one, he would. Yeah, I'll like pick it up from my agent's office. That's the plan.
That's great.
That's really wonderful. So you have a concert coming up at Carnegie Hall on April 18th, Saturday, April 18th. Tell us about that.
Well, we're very excited. This is the first time that I get to be a part of it, but this is, the second or third year that they've done this. And it's sort of a new-ish initiative that they're doing that's also in tune with this Wild Music Institute that they've started at Carnegie Hall. And it's all about music education and especially music education for young people. So the concert is geared toward young people and their families to come to Carnegie Hall. And it's going to be interactive, which is going to be really fun. the audience is going to be learning songs with us and dancing with us. We're going to be on stage, in the house. It's going to be really fun.
Yes, and apparently some of the kids are going to get to go on stage at Carnegie and perform.
This is what I hear as well. Like, how cool would that be, right?
Thrilling.
Yeah.
So
you come as
saying?
An audience member, and you end up getting to stand and sing at Carnegie Hall, on the Carnegie Hall stage.
Do you know what you're singing?
All kinds of stuff. We're doing, me specifically, I'm doing some stuff from The Sound of Music. I'm doing some stuff from Les Mis, some stuff from Beautiful. But we're also doing things from Grease and Hairspray, some dance stuff. So it kind of runs the gambit of all. It's a nice sort of exposure to a bunch of different musical theater and Broadway songs. And then the other element of it, too, is Leslie Stifelman, who's also the music director over at Chicago the Musical and conductor over there. She and her partner, Melissa Ray Mahone, are sort of, they headed this up with Tom Cabanis, and the whole idea is to also introduce kids to the different kind of jobs that are needed on Broadway. Like, we talk about music directors, we talk about choreographers, which is really interesting for kids too, because it sort of exposes them to some of those jobs that you don't necessarily see if you go see a Broadway show, but that are absolutely integral to how it all comes together.
That's fantastic, because obviously the focus is normally on the performers, which of course
right.
where it should be, but
right.
Yes,
well, I mean,
all those
stuff,
wonderful
stuff you see, you know.
Yeah.
In fact, when you were a little girl,
we couldn't do what we do without all that other thing. Pardon?
When you were a little girl, did you know you were going to be a performer? When did it hit you that this is something you wanted to do or were going to do?
I mean, I think I was exposed to it at a young age. Both of my parents are actors. I grew up in Chicago, and they were very active there in the theater community. And so I remember seeing shows when I was about 4 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it always had an appeal to me, and it was also what my parents did. So it was like, oh, that's, you know, that's what mommy and daddy do. That's a great thing. So, excuse me. But so I think at an early age, I thought this would be really great to do. And then I got a little bit older. I didn't really do any theater performing when I was little. It wasn't really until I got to high school that I started doing plays in my high school. That was just sort of the first opportunity. But then by the time sort of college rolled around, I still thought I wanted to do it, but I was very wary. I think by that point I kind of had a little bit of a reality check about maybe what a life in the business would be like.
Okay, in fact, did your parents?
I don't think that's ever stopped. that sort of doubt of, it's such a funny sort of strange life choice, and I still to this day really applaud people who find a way to balance it well, because I think it's very, very tricky.
It is, and
I'm sure coming from me, that doesn't sound like much to a lot of people, because it probably seems like in the eyes of a lot of people, people would say I'm very successful, and I have had a great deal of success, and I'm very grateful for that, but there's the other side of it that I always know it can always end.
Well, having your parents in the business, and you've been able to see that.
In fact, were they encouraging or were they discouraging, knowing the realities of the business?
No, they were very encouraging. It's like I hesitate to say they were neutral, but there wasn't anything. I never remembered them sort of warning. My brothers and sisters also all act, and I never remember them sort of warning us against the pitfalls. Like, I don't know if you really want to do this. It was, they were realistic about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I think from the sense that they know what it's like to do this and to feel the ups and downs, and I'm sure nobody wants that for their children. But when they saw that we all had a true interest in it and a drive for it, they have always been very, very supportive.
So you've been out of Beautiful for just a few weeks now.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find yourself not knowing what to do with your day?
Oh, totally. Oh, my gosh. I was so proud of myself the last couple of weeks. I was, like, doing really, really well.
Cleaning your room.
I was like, yeah, I was waking up late, having coffee till 2. I was like, I'm going to watch television. You know what I mean? I watched like all of Nashville. I got obsessed. I did a couple concerts here and there with my friend Jared Spector, who's in Beautiful, and that was great. And then, so funny you say this, because yes, in the last couple of days, I've kind of like, what am I doing with my life? Will I ever work again? Like, what did we? So that's what I mean. I just don't think. I think it maybe, not that I have any grand sort
scheme.
Of, yeah, I was like, why am I even, you know, say my life thoughts about the business or what I do? Why does that matter? But it's like the things that give you the ability to do what an actor does sometimes make it very difficult to function in normal life. So yeah, it's a balancing act. But like, I got some laundry done yesterday. I was proud of myself.
Excellent.
That was useful.
Well, with the news in the last week or so that Beautiful is going to become a movie, is there anything in the back of your head that says I want to do that? Or we just actually spoke to James Lapine last week, and I asked him if he wants to ever go back and do something, and he's like, no, I never want to go back. I only want to go forward. So is that something?
Oh,
you know?
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I'd love to, you know, depending on what happens with it and what direction they're going with it, I think I'd love to at least get in the room and audition. I don't know. Yeah, but that's a funny question, right? It's like you sort of close a chapter on something, and what would it be like to sort of reopen it? I don't know.
Given the fact it took so long for Carol King to get involved and show up at the show, what was it like when you finally met her? Or did you meet her earlier on?
I'd met her once before.
Oh, okay.
We did the show. It was also a surprise, so we did the show out of town in San Francisco, and then we came back to rehearse again in New York before we started previews in New York. And the first day we came back and went into to rehearsal, when we got back to New York, she showed up at the rehearsal room, and nobody knew. I mean, maybe like a stage manager knew she was coming, but none of the cast knew. I remember walking into the building behind Jared Spector. I saw him down the street, and I was like, oh, I'm going to bum rush him, give him a hug. And I come into the vestibule by the elevators, and I swear, I was like, I saw the back of Carol's head, and I just knew. I saw the hair, and I was like, oh, I guess this is happening today. She was so cool. And she's been like that every subsequent time that I've had interactions with her, just very open and warm. And it's been thrilling for everyone involved in the show to see how much she's always been behind it to a degree, and always in a way that I think was up to her, which is absolutely correct, and how she wanted to be connected with it and how much she wanted to be sort of in the light of it all, you know what I mean? But it's been so rewarding for everyone involved in the process to watch her like really become on board and just be all in, you know what I mean, after she saw it, and being with us at the Tonys, and, you know, going to the London opening. And it's just, it's great, because it feels like the best affirmation we could get is that the woman whose story we were all telling, and they're still telling, you know what I mean, approves of it, basically. You know what I mean? It feels proud of it.
Sure.
So your sister Abby is in Kinky Boots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, these siblings that are just locking up Broadway here. That's awesome. Can we look forward to maybe a 54 Below of Jesse and Abby?
You know what? It's funny you say that. We've actually been talking about that a lot. I've been doing the concerts with my friend Jared Spector, like I said, and which has sort of opened me up to that world. He's been doing that for a while, and I've seen his solo shows, and I just think the world of him anyway, but he came to me and he was like, would you maybe want to do something together? And I was like, yeah, I think so, because I'm scared to do it on my own at first. And so I feel like I've learned a lot from him doing that for, you know, the last month or so. And I was just talking to Abby the other day. I mean, we've always loved singing together, and we were like, we should do a show. So I also have a lot of respect for the work that goes into putting something like that together. So, but I think it's definitely something she and I are going to work on. You know what I mean? Just start getting together, start getting songs together that we love and want to sing. And I think it could be a really cool, it could be a really cool show, a really kind of cool perspective to share with an audience, I think.
Are there any other Muellers that are performers?
I have my brother Matt Mueller and my brother Andrew Mueller. They're both in Chicago right now. Andrew was here for a while with Peter and the Starcatcher when it went off Broadway. Yeah, he was here for almost like over a year. And Matt's been like all over the country and doing all kinds of shows and premieres of new shows and things like that. So knock on wood, we're all keeping busy. And
your parents have
we like it that way.
Your parents have absolutely nothing to talk about at dinner parties. Everybody's like, "Oh, there's a Mueller Stone."
Yeah, they're like, "No, we don't know where our children are. They're somewhere."
they're like, "That one won a Grammy and a Tony, and I can't invite them out anymore." You know.
Are you going to London to see Beautiful? Just out of curiosity.
Oh, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I think it would be cool, and I haven't been to London since I was like in high school, so it would be fun.
They were very lucky.
I think it'll run a nice long time, so I don't have to hurry over there. But
they were very lucky to have you. I think the show's terrific, and I think Doug McGrath did a very good job in telling a story that has been told many, many times. After all, rags to riches in show business, and yet he made us care about the people. But you brought to it that wonderful self-deprecating humor, that little laugh you used to give, made us all identify with you, that we all know what it's like to struggle when we're starting out and doing the best we can and hoping that it's going to work out. You really embody that so well, and you are certainly a great building block in their success, as good as the show is.
Yes.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you very much.
So, Jesse, thank you so much for joining us on a Sunday morning, especially after, you know, your long run.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys.
And you're taking it. So I want to remind listeners that you can catch up with Jesse on April 18th at Carnegie Hall at the Family Concert. And we'll have links to that in our show notes if you want to find out more information. Jesse, have a wonderful time, and we will talk to you back again soon. Maybe you'll be a three-time repeat.
We love it. Parents. We love it, yeah. And come see us at Carnegie Hall.
All right. We'll speak to you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye-bye, guys. And it's too
So last week we talked a little bit about The Hunchback of Notre Dame and Heidi Chronicles, but Peter had to run early to go see a show in Jersey, so we didn't get Peter's take on it. Peter, why don't you start us off with Heidi Chronicles? What did you think about it?
Well, you know, it was funny because last week we had a difference of opinion on Heidi Chronicles, with a woman liking it very much and a man not liking it that much. I'm somewhere in between. I don't know what that says about me, but that's another story entirely. But altogether, I felt the play was overwritten. It much too long. I wish that somebody had come in with a blue pencil or any color pencil for that matter and cut lines here and there. That was my take more than anything else. I have a very different take on dated anyway. When people say, oh, something's dated, I just see things as time machines, as time capsules that we can go back and see what people were thinking at that time. And I appreciate plays for that reason that go back in time. It doesn't have to be relevant to today. I like to see where we've been, how we got to where we've been. And I think the play is successful there. But my, is it long. However, very well done. No quarrel with that. Certainly Elizabeth Moss did the job, but it's always fun to see Tracy Chimo, who's one of my favorite young performers. And certainly Jason Biggs was very good, too, in playing the smug would-be boyfriend who has a million problems of his own. So good production. But, whoa, you better have some caffeine before you go in there because you're going to need it. You're going to be there quite a while.
Well, Peter, as you may recall, one of my specific objections was that it sometimes literally seemed to me that every other line was some kind of pop culture joke or some joke about a city or, a movie or a book or a school. And it just seemed like a lot of really cheap humor about, you know, even at one point there was a joke about Boston, which really wasn't even funny. And it's just she expected people to laugh because she said, oh, you know, Boston, blah, blah, blah. And did you notice how many of those there were? And did that bother you?
It didn't bother me, but I certainly noticed them. Okay. I think there was a specific attempt to give us time, place, and feeling, and that's a way of doing it. I think people enjoy that, frankly. Apparently you don't, and that's fine, but I think people enjoy hearing little touchstones. I'm reminded of my friend David Wolfe, the late great David Wolfe, who rarely laughed at anything. I had taken him to the theater so many times, and he was very critical, so on and so forth, and one time Jerome Avenue came up, and he started laughing. Well, what's so funny about Jerome Avenue? Well, he used to live there, you know. So I think you know, relate to that type of thing. So I think those little touchstones help. So they don't bother me, but I can understand why they.
I don't. I enjoy them too. I just that to me there were many. So many.
Peter, I have a question for you. Yeah. Did you see any other productions of Heidi Chronicles in your history?
Yeah, the original, and one at the Two River Theater Company in Red Bank many moons ago.
So, did this production seem longer, or was it just that it was just long again? Like,
I'm interested to hear what Peter has to say about that, because I thought that this one, I completely agree that this one seemed very, very long, especially in Act Two, and I did not remember feeling that way about the original, and I was younger then. I don't know if that would make it more or less likely for me to think it was longer. So, Peter?
No, I felt it was – I always felt it was a long play.
Okay.
I thought Pam McKinnon directed with a very sure hand. And I wonder if Wendy were around today, if she would feel the same way and just say, oh, I got to throw out that line, this line. Everybody was so looking forward to this play way back when, because Wendy was really on the rise. And this was everybody felt this was going to be the masterpiece. And I just wonder if indeed people were just too gingerly accepting it and just feeling, well, this is what Wendy has given us, and she knows what she's doing, and far be it from us to play with it. So I know that's reasonably unlikely, but still it occurred to me because this was the one. Everybody expected it. So,
Peter, did you ever have the opportunity to interview Wendy?
Oh, yeah. Wendy and I had many wonderful experiences together.
So I really never had – I've been in the same room with her in the past, but never really spoken to her in an extended period of time. But it seemed like this was – Heidi Chronicles is kind of her voice. This is how she is.
Oh, yeah. It's certainly her voice. I never heard her talk as much as she does in this play. But I did panel discussions with Wendy, two of them, one here in New York and one in Princeton. And we certainly got along very, very well. I was at her apartment once, so on and so forth. But I do think she went on a little long in this
okay.
one.
Okay.
You, of course, her death was sad under any circumstances. But one thing that made it even sadder for me was that I believe the last thing she wrote, the play called Third,
yeah.
which was at Lincoln Center. Wasn't it like being performed like just before or during the
just
time?
Just before,
that she,
I think.
Yeah. Although I don't remember it being perfect, there was some really, really wonderful stuff in that play.
I agree entirely.
And very different from anything else she wrote that I know of.
Right.
So I thought that was made it even sadder that she seemed to be, you know, really kind of moving into new areas and really pushing herself and challenging herself in terms of what she was writing about.
Well, the other thing, too, is it's impossible to watch this play, especially the last scene, and not wonder what's happened to Wendy's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't heard a word about her, and I guess she's being very protected and kept under wraps. I don't even know remotely where she is, who she is, but she's got to be in her teens now, and if not, very close to it. And I hope she's doing well.
Peter, also, Michael sort of started at least a handful of emails and tweets to me and things like that about Elizabeth Moss's voice. What did you think? You mentioned that you enjoyed seeing Elizabeth Moss. Did you have anything to say about anything else about her performance?
Gee, Michael, refresh my memory.
It wasn't. I don't think it was email. I just said on last week's podcast that I found her voice. I found that when she, in trying to project in a theater, that her voice got a rather unpleasant quality, rather shrill and thin, and I didn't enjoy hearing that for 3 hours.
That's funny, because that was my take on Larry David in Fish in the Dark.
I confuse those two.
They do, don't they? And we have to talk about Fish in the Dark and what's going on there, too.
Oh, yeah.
No, I didn't feel that at all.
Okay. All right. And in the case of Larry David, you know, guys, it is so amazing. You would think some things are not a matter of opinion. I have heard from several people that Larry David is mumbling. I have heard from several people that he doesn't cheat out to the audience, that he's always looking sideways, that he can't act. Many people have said, come right out and said that. And I didn't notice any of that when I went. In fact, I commented the opposite, that I was amazed how assured he seemed on stage, considering he has absolutely no experience whatsoever. I mean, to me, for that kind of comedy, he just did it perfectly. And I heard every word he said. I thought he was cheating out when he needed to, and looking out when he needed to, and looking at the other people when he needed to. So that really confounded me, because you would think that's not really so much a matter of opinion.
Maybe it's Frank Sinatra, who can't do it same take twice.
And Dean Martin, too. Yeah. I felt that while I was watching Fish in the Dark, that while everybody was talking and then Larry David spoke, it was like watching a TV show where the volume was turned down every time he spoke.
Really?
So I have to say that in a way this was a good thing, because I find this play the most mean-spirited play that we've had in a long time. So it was good not to hear some of the dialogue as well. But all things considered, I agree with you. He was assured up there.
Just in terms of volume.
Volume. That was my only problem.
I did not.
I'm not saying I couldn't hear him. I could. Right. All I'm saying, he wasn't at the same level of pitch that everybody else seemed to be.
Well, then, you know what? I think maybe James has it. Maybe he's just very inconsistent from one night to the next, because that he's certainly never done before. But I swear to God, I didn't notice that at all. He seemed completely clear, and volume-wise, he was perfect. That's so interesting.
All right. So let's move forward to Hunchback of Notre Dame that Michael and Carrie talked about last week. Peter, what was your take on Hunchback?
There were some marvelous things in it, especially the way that they introduced the hunchback. Michael Alden, who's terrific, comes in looking like Michael Alden, and then what they do is put a hunch on his back. They tie it on, and he puts some goop on his face, and he adopts the difficult expression. And this, I think, is a very clever device, because having him come out looking terrible right at the very beginning would be off-putting. One of the things about the movie is that the hunchback, while certainly not a looker, does, you know,
he's cute. He's cute.
He is kind of cute in a way. He sort of looks like Nathan Lane to me. But you know, it's easier in a cartoon to do that type of thing. And I think the idea of having him come on and put on the hunch, it eases us into it, very much eases us, and puts us at ease. So I like that very, very much. I didn't like the gargoyles giving so much narration, and I wish that would cut down a bit, or I wish they would come forward a bit, because they do seem to be in the shadows, and I understand that point of view. What hurt it for me more than anything else, I think the biggest miscalculation was the unit set. And I think this is a show where you really need much more realistic sets. I always hate unit sets anyway, because they suggest they're doing something on the cheap. But the famous moment in Hunchback is when he rescues Esmeralda and takes her into the church and says sanctuary. Well, all he is in the same playing area he's been all night long. We don't see that sanctuary. We don't see him taking her into the church. And really what you need is a marvelous set coming in of the church and his taking her in it. So that's what bothered me more than anything else. Stephen Schwartz's lyrics, terrific. Alan Menken's music does the job, no question. It is very different from the animated feature, and they wanted it to be. So it's a very serious musical. Very little humor, very little. And and not the and I'm sure this was discussed by our two luminaries last week, but the idea of losing the gargoyles who are funny, I think was a good thing, because they did smack of Disneyism, you know, oh, we got to get in these cute little things here to, audience liked it quite a bit though, quite a bit. So, I don't know if we're going to see this on Broadway.
Yeah.
I doubt it, frankly, though, I have heard that they really believe that this is coming in, they being the people at the Paper Mill Playhouse. That's what I'm told. By the way, these are rumors. This is not like I've talked to anybody. So again, I never say that what I say is true. I only tell you what I hear. But they seem to be making plans. I have a feeling that they're going to die out. So
I completely agree with Peter about the unit set. In fact, I was thinking that just before he first said it to me right after the show. One would think it would not be that difficult with Paper Mill's facilities to just fly – to have flown out the walls.
No.
It's supposed to be the bell tower, I suppose, right? Wouldn't you say that's what?
Yeah.
But I don't know why they didn't do that. I think that was a big mistake. And then as far as the introduction of the Hunchback, I agree with you on the effectiveness of that. But it occurred to me, do you think that was influenced by the Elephant Man?
It didn't occur to me, but I see your point.
It's very similar. I mean, bring the person out, you know, as they are, have us, you know, be able to relate to them in both cases. Really good-looking, you know, youngish men, and then do the transformation before your eyes. So it's kind of like you see the inner person, and you're able to relate to them more rather than a monster of some sorts. Of course, in the Elephant Man, he never really, you know, I mean, he bends himself over, but he never puts on a hump or any kind of monster makeup or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So anyway.
So, it's totally gone out of my head. I was thinking about something and it is gone. All right. So let's move forward. Maybe we'll come back to this. Oh, no. I remembered what it was now.
Good.
Okay. So, Peter, you did mention last week that you only say what you hear.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about in retrospect to Peter Gallagher on the 20th Century. Mm. But in fact... I can't vouch for all the information that you said, but they did in fact record a cast recording on Monday. Mm-hmm. So he was out on Sunday, and they recorded on Monday. But word is that he's been out again this week.
Yes,
and he has two upcoming scheduled absences, which clearly are not for illness. I'm afraid, I hate to say it, like rumors are swirling. He's doing TV pilots, whatever it is. I just think it's a really unfortunate situation.
It certainly is.
Can somebody call up Judy Kay and see if she can come in?
She knows the part. I bet she still remembers it. Judy's got a fabulous memory.
Is it a jinxed production?
Well, a jinxed show is
a jinxed show. I should
right,
say, yeah.
Yeah, right. You know, yeah. But really, I have to say that the people I know who have seen the understudy, Mr. Moy, and in fact, I know a lot of people now who have seen him, tell me he's very good. So at least that.
Well, there's that tradition of Christine Ebersole.
You know. Sure. Yeah, well, right. Yeah.
As I may have mentioned, I saw James Moy in several shows down in the D.C. area, most memorably as File in 110 in the Shade. And he really was fantastic. So I don't, not having seen him in this role, I can't say if I think he fits it. But I do know that as a talent, he's really very, very special.
Wonderful.
All right. So let's move forward. Michael, you got a chance to see, let me get this, correct me if I'm wrong, Manon.
Perfect.
Manon at the Metropolitan Opera. So, Michael, why don't you tell us about that?
Well, this is a fairly new production that came from that didn't initiate at the Met. It started at Covent Garden, I believe, and it's being shared among different opera houses. They move the action is normally supposed to take place in the middle of the 18th century, and they moved it up 100 years more than 100 years, I guess, to the end of the 19th century. There's been a trend for some years in opera production to do the operas at the time when they were written, rather than when they were originally set, for reasons that I guess, you know, we can all imagine. And in this case, the updating I thought worked very well. I was extremely annoyed by the actual production concept, the sets, and the direction. But one interesting thing is that in moving it up, especially in the beginning, the main character is a very young girl. She's supposed to be 16, who is, how can I say, she's started to get into trouble. She's a little bit concerned with boys and pleasure and things like that. So they're sending her to a convent. But on the way, she meets this young man, and they run off together. And in this production, when she first came on, I swear she looked like Gigi, because she had the little straw hat with the bow on it. And so that just struck me as funny. And a lot of the costumes were reminiscent of Gigi, in the general time and style. But in a way, this is kind of like the opposite story of what might have happened to Gigi if she weren't so smart and sweet and intelligent, because this woman winds up coming to a very bad end because she cannot stay faithful to her lover. Whereas Gigi, as I've said, you know, I think it really is. Gigi is, oddly enough, quite a feminist story that people sometimes don't see that, because they only see, they get distracted by other aspects of it and the whole courtesan aspect of it, and that turns them off. But I hope when people see Gigi, you know, that they will realize that it really is about a very strong, smart young woman who really makes a lot of self-determination in her decisions. I was really glad to see Manon, because even though the production I really did not like at all, the orchestra was beyond sublime, and it had two of the greatest singing actors on the opera stage today, Vittorio Grigolo and Diana Damrau. And both, not only are they both great actors and singers, but they're both gorgeous. There's a scene. this is how Manon operates. After she breaks up with her lover at one point, then she decides she wants to get him back, but she finds out he's become a priest, basically. So she goes to the church and seduces him in the church. And so that's a pretty famous scene, and they really played it for all it was worth. They even had a bed like off to the side. I guess it was supposed to be an anteroom, and at the end of it, both of them fall on it singing passionately, and then she rips off his shirt, and the curtain comes down, and the audience goes nuts. So it was quite an exciting evening at the Metropolitan Opera.
Well, it's not what laymen would expect of the opera, so maybe we'll get some more folks there.
It's a beautiful opera.
Oh, it's so great to hear.
Oh, and one other thing. The history of it is really kind of interesting, because this opera was written by Jules Massenet, and it was a big hit all over the world. And then not too many years later, Puccini decided he was going to write an opera about the same thing. And people told him he was nuts, and he said no, and he went ahead and did it, and it became it was one of his first hit, actually, and then over the years it's become even more popular. But it's so amazing. It's kind of like if someone had decided to write a new musical version of The King and I in 1975, you know. it's almost gutsier, you know, than that situation we had with the two wild parties at the same time, because theoretically those people were, you know, they both had the idea and they were working on it, and they didn't know if either one of them was going to become a hit. But this, as I say, this Manon was a big hit, and Puccini just had the nerve to write the same story. It's really incredible.
Michael, can you remind listeners who don't go to the Met, you know, kind of, are there friendly prices that they can be had?
I am not completely familiar with it, but I know they have some kind of rush, and they've actually increased. I think they've made more availability in recent years because they're, like so many other places, they're struggling to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. So yes, you should definitely check in. They have different types of rush policy. They also have standing room, which is not bad. This opera is 4 hours long, but they're not all that long.
I was gonna mention that it's five acts or six acts?
Five acts, but only two intermissions.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So today is the 29th. It's Sunday of March. And unfortunately, if you're listening to this, you have missed Hazel Flagg at Musicals Tonight, but Michael and Peter are here to give you the recount of it. So Peter, why don't you start us off with Hazel Flagg?
The musical stinks. It's really terrible, and that's really too bad because it should have been wonderful. This is based on Nothing Sacred, and a movie that came out in the 30s with Carol Lombard and Frederick March. She's been deemed ill, terminally ill, and Frederick March, a newspaper reporter, sees this as a great story. He's going to bring her to New York. He's going to wine and dine her, make her the toast of the town as a big send-off. She finds out she's not sick. The doctor made a mistake. And, but who can blame her for wanting to come to New York? She just cannot tell the truth because a free trip to New York, having a good time here? Well, very good. You would think the movie would make an excellent musical for another reason. The movie is literally, I mean this, 75 minutes long. You know, plenty of room for songs and dances, I'll tell you. Julie Stein wrote the music, and I think a lot of his music is very good in the show, especially the what is almost the 11 o'clock number called Everybody Loves to Take a Bow, a terrific song and a smart idea for a song, because what it's talking about is the fact we all need respect. We all need recognition. And the lyric, Bob Hilliard's lyric ends with, I want a headline in red and my picture on the front page. Now, if it started out that way, talking about that, it would seem too egocentric. But taking a bow is easier than that. So I like that lyric quite a bit. And there's a wonderful song called Every Street's a Boulevard in Old New York that's sung by the mayor. And I'm not sure that every street is a boulevard in Old New York. I've certainly been on plenty that haven't been, but that's another story. It's just that the songs are in the wrong places. That's the real problem. Ben Hecht, who had worked on the movie, was asked to do the book, and I guess he did a serviceable enough job. But I don't understand why somebody wasn't around to say, there's your song. Mm-hmm. So many times, song cues were just leaping out, and they just weren't happening. Also, I'm afraid Hazel has a very bad early song when she sings I'm Glad I'm Leaving, which is an up-tempo song, and she's putting down Vermont. It shouldn't be a case where you hate Vermont and love New York. It should be a case that, to paraphrase Shakespeare, that you it's not that you love Vermont less, it's that you love New York more. But I'm Glad I'm Leaving, after people have given her this big send-off, makes her spiteful and lousy, frankly. So I think that's a problem. However, very nice people in Mel Miller's production. Nothing wrong with what he did there. The cast was very, very winning. But we also have to remind you, this was also an era where books had a lot of dialogue between songs. Mm-hmm. And so there were plenty of arid stretches where you wish somebody would start singing, especially given that Julie Stein was on the job.
Michael, what did you think?
Well, I do the production photos for Musicals Tonight, so full disclosure there. And also, I only saw Act One because I how I shoot their shows, and I had to leave that night, and I didn't get back. But I completely agree. I thought Savannah Fraser, who played Hazel, was excellent. And also, Jason Mills, who many of us know from Forbidden Broadway, was Wallace Cook, the newspaper guy, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They were both really great. And I had an odd experience, actually, Peter, because I went into it. I have the album, but I never listened to it. So I was sitting there and I was really laughing during the rehearsal. And of course, there was no one else there except the director and Mel Miller. And so this there I am laughing and I'm like, the only one there to laugh. But I really was kind of amused by so much of it now. But I'm talking about the book, not necessarily the lyrics so much. So I think enough of the film script by Ben Hecht survives. There are some really, really funny lines there. And that's what I was responding to. And then I remember Peter saying it was a terrible, or whatever word you use, musical. And I went home and put on the cast album and thought, gee, it's really not very good, is it? It's an odd mélange of I think a very good book, and as Peter said, maybe songs that are not great and are not in the right places.
All right, so swing and a miss coming up on baseball season for a rare swing and a miss for musicals tonight, I would think. So Michael got a chance to see Standard Time with Michael Feinstein, Beyond the Rainbow, celebrating Yip Harburg. So, Michael, that was at Carnegie Hall. Tell us about that.
Well, they do such wonderful concerts there. And the guests, Michael himself does a lot of singing and playing piano. The last one I had gone to was David Raxon, who was a film composer. But this one is really more Broadway-centric, and that is E.Y. Yip Harburg, who, aside from writing maybe the most famous song ever written, Over the Rainbow, wrote Finian's Rainbow and Bloomer Girl, and had quite a lovely career on Broadway also. The guests were Nancy Anderson, whom I've always loved, Malcolm Getz, same there, and Catherine Russell, who I was not previously familiar with, but boy, am I going to look for her. She is a jazz blues singer with a really, really beautiful, very big voice, but big voice she can scale down and become very intimate when she needs to. She sang, among other songs, The Eagle and Me. Mm. From Bloomer Girl, which is a really great song. And it was a wonderful night, marred by the fact that, oh my God, how do we stop this? There were people walking in 20 minutes into the concert. And the way that Zankel Hall is set up, they have to clump down wooden steps on the side. There's no center aisle, so they clump down all the way like towards the front, then they disturb everyone to sit down. That was one couple, and then they stayed for about half an hour, and then the two of them left about 20 minutes before the end, with her big shopping bag. And these were only two of like 20 people who came in late.
Michael, let me ask this. Did the concert start at an atypical time? Because I notice when if it shows 7 o'clock, at 7:15, plenty of people are coming in because they thought it was an 8 o'clock curtain.
It was in fact 7:30, which is an odd time. And so, yes, yeah. You could. Yeah. But what about the leaving early? And also.
Oh, no. Just asking.
Yeah. I mean.
No, that's house management's got to solve that issue.
I always think the best thing to do is to leave seats at the back, which is easier said than done. But I really think that's the best thing to do rather than have people. I mean, it was so distracting. Harold Arlen's sister-in-law was seated in front of us, and she was almost apoplectic at one point. Yeah, it was so distracting.
Manhattan Theater Club's second space, what they do is they reserve some very good seats for people who come in late. I think it's a little unfair because you come in late, you get a better seat than you do if you on time.
And I think they do that also at CSC.
Yes. Yeah. Right.
I've been late to a CSC show. I had a car accident right before I was going to go see a CSC show a couple of months ago, and they gave my tickets away to somebody else and put me in the first two seats as you first walk in. So that's great.
Right.
That is smart house management.
That's great. It's all house management. It's really very smart. But you know, the odd start time, I don't know, it's so hard to get people to pay attention these days, you know. Oh,
I always do double check things.
Yeah,
at least twice.
Yeah, but we're used to it. It's part of our, you know.
Of course, we have to.
Yeah, exactly. So, Michael, your alma mater, Wagner College, has the Stanley Drama Award, and you have some news on that front, don't you?
Yes, they had their annual ceremony. They give out an award every year to a play, and then they have two runners-up each year. The winner gets $2,000, so which is nothing to sneeze. Nothing to sneeze at.
Well, I'm thinking about writing a show right now.
Or nothing to stutter about either. See how excited I got? And the wonderful thing about this is they had Wagner College students performing from some of their recent shows, one of which I had seen, Merrily We Roll Along, one of which I had not seen, Spamalot, which they did some really great moments from that. But then they had an excerpt from the winning play, which is called The Good Bet by Bob Kleiman. And as we all know, it can be very difficult to excerpt a play and have it be effective. But they picked two really good scenes from this play, which is about middle-aged couple with children growing up to getting around college age, and they have an old friend, and this old friend is involved in is doing very, very well, but his business is something that his friends, the couple, have, or at least the husband, have objections to on moral grounds. So the guy with the money offers to pay full scholarships for the children of his friends, and they, as incredibly helpful as that would be, they have a real struggle about it because of their moral questions about the business that this guy is in. And we didn't get to see in this two scenes how it turned out, but I really want to see. So I hope I get to see the whole play at some point.
I've seen many of Bob Kleiman's plays. He's a New Jersey playwright, and he was produced quite a bit of Playwrights Theater of New Jersey. He's also a psychiatrist, and I guess most psychiatrists should be writing plays because they certainly understand the human condition. At least ideally they should. So I'm not surprised that this has tremendous potential.
Well, really, just from those two excerpts, I would say it was one of the best things I've seen recently.
Look at that.
Yeah.
Good for Bob.
Yep.
All right. So next up, we wanted to mention in the news that the Fantastics is closing at the Snapple Center. Now, how did you guys feel about the headlines that were going around? I think I saw one that said after 55 years.
Yeah.
And they've always fudged it. If you read the press release, it did clarify within that this is not the same production. And in fact, if you all remember, if I remember, what happened was that the original one at the Sullivan Street closed after like 42 years, something like that. Mm-hmm. Then the new production was done at the Snapple Center, and a recording was made of that production. But then that one closed and then reopened not that long later. I think that had to do with change in producer.
Oh.
So it's actually now whether that those two can be considered the same production is a matter of that's a matter of question, but that is what happened as I remember it.
What's so interesting is that even this revival ran an astonishingly long time, longer than virtually every other off-Broadway show that's ever been produced. So it's pretty impressive when a show could only be away for a few years and then come back. The difference, of course, was it was in a different neighborhood. And it does bring up the point that off-Broadway really doesn't have to be down in the village or anywhere that we used to associate it way back when. That New World Stages has certainly proved that, too. There's an audience for off-Broadway, if indeed it is convenient to that TKTS booth. Yes. That's what's really significant, because so many times people make decisions on if the streets have numbers so they can find it easily, as opposed to streets with names like Sullivan Street. It's harder to get to. Now, Lord knows that the Fantastic did suffer for being on Sullivan Street, because yes, 42 years is 42 years. But I never thought, though, that it was going to run as long as it did here in Uptown. I was very surprised. I'm delighted. It's a wonderful show, and I think it's a tremendous – you don't need me to tell you anything good about the Fantastics. You know that already. But isn't it something that it winds up being one of the longest-running off-Broadway shows in its revival, as well as, of course, in its original run? So
on a related note, the film version, I'm told, is about to be released on Blu-ray. Mm-hmm. And what's really interesting about that is I'm told that it has an alternate director's cut I don't know if that's the word for it. The film was originally released. No, the film was originally made by Michael Ritchie. And then before it was released, Francis Ford Coppola got involved and re-edited it and made major changes, like cutting out "Try to Remember" at the beginning of the movie so that you don't hear it until the very end, and then most of it is in a voiceover anyway. Now, I think he kind of wrecked the movie, aside from the problems that it already has. And I used to have a VHS copy of the original cut, which I consider far superior. So now everyone will be able to judge which one they like better. And I would not be very surprised if most people say, oh, well, it was better before Coppola got his hands on it.
All right. Running almost as long as The Fantastics is Larry David's Fish in the Dark. And we hear that on June 9th, Jason Alexander is going to take over for Larry David, and which it's awfully coincidental that June 9th is the date. What do you think about that?
What do you mean?
I sort of feel like, you know, after the Tonys are all announced, he doesn't care about Broadway.
Oh, he had always said, yeah, June 7th was going to be it. I would like to have been a fly on the wall to find out exactly what happened here. Not that this is any type of scandal or anything like that. I don't mean anything of the kind. But I wonder if Jason Alexander went to Larry David and said, I'd love to play this part. Or was it Larry David saying, you know, Jason, I think you'd be good for this. And was Jason enthusiastic about it? Did he feel, well, I certainly owe my life to Larry David. I'm going to do it. I wonder if he likes the play. Because I don't. And I know Michael does. I just wonder what his level of enthusiasm was and who initiated the situation. But I think it's great that Jason's coming back to Broadway. And I, even though I don't like the play, I would enjoy seeing him in it to see how he handles it.
And, you know, an interesting thing there is there again, just is it opinion? Is it mood? I agree with you that Fish in the Dark is terribly mean-spirited. For some reason, it didn't bother me, whereas it's only a play. I just really despised it. So I don't know what the difference is there.
Well, it'll be interesting because Jason, one of the criticisms was that Larry David was too old and Jason is probably more age appropriate. So, but I'd imagine that this is just a financial grab because the show, you can't get a ticket to it. So let's extend it, but Larry's not going to do it. So let's grab somebody else who's just as big of a well-known name. And Jason Alexander, surely most welcome back on Broadway anytime he wants, in any role he wants. He could play Carrie Pepperidge for all I care.
Sure. You know?
I wonder how long, if this was actually in the air, because I swear to God I heard somebody say a few months ago, well, if they ever tried to keep it going after he leaves, the only person in the world who could possibly replace him would be Jason Alexander.
It's very interesting.
I suppose Jerry Seinfeld could too, but I don't think that's going to happen. Yeah.
All right. So I want to do some you know what? I have one more story that we want to just touch on for a minute, is that we hear in the news a couple of weeks ago that Toys R Us is leaving Times Square.
Oh, yes.
And I thought that was a very interesting thing, because that's a big footprint on Times Square and very public footprint on Times Square right across from the TKTS booth. And the interesting part that I read in the story is that Toys R Us is currently paying $10 million a month in rent. Mm. $10 million a month. Mm. So, and that the landlord really actually wants $20 million. Mm. And And so how does that impact Broadway? I mean, those type of numbers, if the landlord is getting that stuff, is it possible that we could lose any theaters on Broadway to, you know, $100 million, $120 million, $200 million a year rents?
How many are landmarked? Do we know? Are they all landmarked?
I don't know.
I think some are.
I look to Michael Portantier for that information.
Yeah. I think they're all landmarked, but also that it's a different situation because they're owned by the companies. And then the other thing is the related news there is, have you been reading recently about the selling of the air rights?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it all, I think they're safe. For both of those reasons, all three of those reasons.
Well, we'll have to see what happens there, but certainly that those are some serious, serious numbers.
And on a related note, this might be even more related to what you're saying. They are about to do a play in an interactive show in the Liberty Theater on 42nd Street, which is the last of the two that have not been renovated there, and they're going to do a play called it's about Ziegfeld and the girl, the woman named Olive, who supposedly still haunts the, is it the New Amsterdam?
I don't know.
Oh, you don't know?
Yeah.
The Olive?
Yeah, yeah. The
ghost?
Disney Theater, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, in that case, I don't know if the facade is landmarked. That might be one that they might be able to tear down if they don't make it a theater again. I'm not sure. It could be like the Henry Miller, where they only had to save the facade and gutted the entire theater and made it the Sondheim. These things can be very complicated.
It's going to be very sad if indeed nobody comes into that Toys R Us space, and we have that boarded up look on Times Square.
I can't imagine.
Well, yeah. $20 million a month is a lot of money.
Money.
I mean, you know. So let's hope that the landlord reconsiders and the Toys R Us make some sort of agreement and compromise or something, because I really do fear when places look empty in Times Square.
Yeah.
It's
reflection
like
back to the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah, it really looks like a mouth with a missing front tooth. Yeah.
Wouldn't you think that the first thing that comes to mind as to what they would replace it with will be a hotel?
Yeah.
I mean, to be in a hotel right on – there are very few that are right.
Yeah.
Right there. There's the Marriott. And
yeah.
And,
yeah, they should name it the Astor too. That'd be good.
Oh, that's
the Astor.
I don't. Do you guys? Do the two of you avoid walking through Times Square as much as I do?
Oh yes. Yeah.
It depends on my mood. Every now and then, I like to be reminded that.
Yeah. I mean, I just try to avoid it. Just
certainly when I'm in a hurry. Yeah.
Yeah, when I'm in a hurry, which I almost always am in a hurry.
Yeah, we all. Yeah.
But I had noticed that the paving of the streets, or the new pedestrian way, is finished and it's beautiful.
Yes.
So we should, if it's 2 a.m, walk through
there and check it out.
It's beautiful.
Main problem is in general, just the foot traffic, but also trying to get across Broadway from one side to the other. You can be waiting in a line to cross the street because there are so many people.
Sure. Also, I wanted to mention that we've been honored in a sort of way that Playbill has a story up by Robbie Rozelle that has eight theater podcast you should be listening to, and we were listed there among the others that are there, and we just were very excited to be recognized like that. I wanted to also let folks know that some folks have been emailing me that they have found us on YouTube, and this is true. We are on YouTube, but actually we're just using YouTube. We don't really expect you to listen to us on YouTube. It's just I use the YouTube service. We upload these podcasts to YouTube because when we upload it to YouTube, obviously there's not video there. You're just going to see a static icon of Broadway Radio, but you can listen to it there, I guess, if you'd like. But I use it because we upload it to YouTube and YouTube transcribes the podcasts. So that's, you know, it's there and out there on YouTube, but obviously we're not going anywhere. You can still download these podcasts and listen to them in the traditional ways that you've always listened to, but we are on YouTube, and that's why we use it. I also wanted to give a big, long overdue thank you to AJ Alvarez down in Texas, who has been helping me out with the Broader Radio website and a few other matters and things like that. And AJ is really wonderful. He's a listener who emailed in and said, hey, you know, I have some free time, so let me help you guys out. So, Peter, we have to answer the Tony question from a few weeks ago about two Tony winning musicals in successive years where leading lady's first song has two words in it and the leading man's last song has two words in it. But before we answer that, I want to remind listeners that we can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. One of the ways you can listen is on the Stitcher app, which is an application for your BlackBerry, Android device, and your iPhone. Or you can listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, Michael, and me, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today, can be found on our show page at BroadwayRadio.com as well. So, Peter, what is the answer to that question?
Well, two musicals that opened, the won Tonys in successive years were Applause and Company. Mm. And in Applause, the opening song for the leading lady is But Alive, while the in Company, the closing song for the leading man is Being Alive. So they were very close that way. And Josh Israel certainly got in touch with me and told me he knew the answer, and he certainly did. So our hats are off to Josh Israel.
We have to get Josh on just to say hello to the IR.
Indeed, that would be very nice.
That would be wonderful. We have another question for this week.
I'm not sure if I gave this, James, so you may have to edit out what I just said. But
sure.
Let me know if I've given this one, because I know I've wanted to give it for a while. Who's the first person to get a Tony nomination for a role that he wasn't doing when rehearsals started, meaning he took over the role out of town? I will admit out of town is important, so therefore you know it's a long time ago, because, of course, today most everybody does previews. But who was the first to get a Tony nomination for a role he wasn't supposed to have in the first place?
I don't think I've ever heard that before. Michael,
okay.
What do you think? Did you guess that before?
No, I don't think you've asked that before. Okay. And that sounds really interesting.
Okay.
All right. So I'm sure that if we have asked that before, people will let us know immediately as they do. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
It doesn't help to know that you're just time away. Long ago, I reached for you and you stood holding you again, could only do me good. How I wish I could, but you're so